Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Jill Ejizi, and you are listening to Family Matters. I'm so glad that you could all be here tonight. I have a surprise for you. Judge Michelle was going to be with us tonight, and I got a last-minute call that she was unavailable. So I am just so happy to announce that my friend and colleague Karen Conti, the lawyer from Chicago, is with us. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Michelle. I just want to—I mean, hi, Jill. I just want to let you know
I put
Michelle's robe on, and I'm sitting here at my desk pretending to be a judge with a gavel in my hand.
Do you have that little lace teddy on underneath that she wears?
are we live?
Yeah, we are. No, she doesn't really do that. I'm kidding. It's usually just a flannel shirt underneath. No, I was referring to her headshot. She had a lovely little lace, you know, thing on, and she always looks great. Of course, people are floored when they find out she's a judge. You know,
she looks more like a movie star. Yeah,
she looks more like a movie star. It's true. But you, as do you. And when I look at you, send me the short bio, and I look at it, and I think, my God, can this woman pack one more thing into this bio? And this is a short one. You had your radio show, Legally Speaking. You're a Fox News contributor. You're on Nancy Grace. You're on every Saturday. You're on CNN with Don Lemon. You're on Court TV, Bill O'Reilly, Good Morning America, Lisa Gibbons, Montel, MSNBC. What else do you do?
I practice law a lot.
You do, and you've really doing some good stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of good family stuff. I'm in a firm called Bierman, and they do some very, very interesting work, the Dwayne Wade divorce and some of the big high-profile cases. And we do really, really good custody and divorce work here, and I'm really proud to be part of this firm.
Yeah, it's a great firm, and Jim Pritikin, of course, who is the senior partner there, is just had done a great thing with Dwayne Wade's case, and what a decision that was.
And very difficult.
And anybody and everybody knows that, because of course that was, you know, anytime there's a parental alienation case with a well-known celebrity, it's all over everywhere. And unfortunately, we need that with the everyday people that it's happening to every day, all day long. So we'll get to that point. We're working on it, I think, and I'm excited tonight to have a great, great guest. This book was brought to my attention, and I said I got to have this guy on, and he is Dr. Edward Farber, and he is a licensed clinical psychologist in Virginia and Maryland, and I'm so glad to know that he's there, because I have calls from that area all the time, people looking for help, and I'm glad to know that he is there. He is on the clinical faculty at George Washington U and is the former chair of psychology at Ohio State University Pediatrics Department and Nationwide Columbus Children's Hospital. He is the most recently has authored this outstanding book that I'm looking at, Raising the Kid You Love with the Ex You Hate. That title is just, I mean, it's got to jump off the shelves. Welcome, Edward.
Hey, thank you very much. And Ed is great, Jill. Good to meet you, Karen. And I'm
glad
like
to
be
Edward.
Here.
I like to say Edward. Can we say Edward? Or
are
no?
You my mother?
Yeah. Did she named you that? I think we should call you that. All right, I'll call you Ed.
But only if I do something bad. You know, then it was, Edward, what did you do now? So other than that.
Well, let's talk about the title of the book. And it is such an incredibly eye-catching title. How did the title come about?
Well, the issue in working with most co-parenting issues is there's really a conflict. Both of these parents end up really deciding that they don't like each other very much, but they still have this common bond. They have this child that they both still love. And there's this real conflict. How do you do this? How do you go about raising this child you love in a co-parenting model with this person that you don't like very much anymore? And most of us don't really have any training in that. You know, when we have kids, we generally have kids with people we love or at least care about, and it shifts, and it's a whole new model. So we have to really address that issue and help people learn an alternative way of raising these kids when the love we once had with someone else is no longer there, burning alive.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it is, I guess, what is the whole system. I mean, you get married, you love somebody, you hope for that great wedding, you hope for a wonderful life, and you love this person. And then how does it get to the point where you so venomously hate that individual that you took the time to say, I'm going to love you no matter what happens until death do us part? How do you get to the point where you hate them that much?
Well, there are several steps along the way, and I think your depiction, Jill, is wonderful. This is the person you love. This is the person you wanted to spend the rest of your life with. This is the person you pictured the white picket fence and the little puppy and the children growing up. And much of that comes true at the beginning. And as whatever the stressors of your marriage develop, that love really does turn to something that's very, very different, and it does turn to an animus and a hostility, one party perhaps toward the other. And the process that we often have to go through in many of our states to accomplish a separation when you no longer love the person you once loved really also helps develop and foster that kind of hatred. It can, it doesn't have to. The truth of it is that 80-85% of families who get divorced end up being able to do that in a somewhat manageable fashion. Yes, there's a sense of loss. Yes, there's a sense of anger toward their ex. But they can do it in a way that's respectable, respectful of each other, and allows them to move on. But it's the 15 or 20% where the level of anger, the level of mistrust is so high that it moves to the level of hostility. You know, if you love someone and then you don't want to be with them, you have to end up hating them in order to justify leaving them.
Well, but don't you think, and I tell my clients this all the time, Ed, that the opposite of love, as they say, is not really hate, but indifference. And when you really love somebody and you break up with them, whether that's a divorce or a breakup, the worst thing that you feel should be indifference, because you don't really even care enough to hate them anymore. But it seems as if when we have children involved and this ongoing back and forth, that that can stoke the indifference into a hatred. If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. And if it wasn't for the children involved and money involved, it might well be only who cares. But now what we have is this process where perhaps for the first time in a co-parenting situation, you have to reach consensus and agreement about your life and your child's life with someone that you don't particularly want to be with. Now, if you want your child to play soccer, you need agreement from the co-parent. If you want to go out of town for the weekend and it's your weekend to be with the child, your agreement may well read that you have to give first right of refusal to the other parent. All of a sudden, the kinds of decisions that we've normally had to make by ourselves, we now have to make with someone we no longer love. And now we have control. I can control this other person sometimes merely by saying no. No, I don't want our daughter to play soccer. I much prefer she spend the time alone with me, not with her friends. No, I no longer want to be able to allow our child to have orthodontia work. I read an article that said orthodontia work isn't really healthy for the young children. And these kinds of decisions that together as a couple you probably made effortlessly, now you have to jointly make these decisions. This apathy can quickly turn to hostility.
Ed, what qualities do you see in parents who are doing a good job co-parenting, and how do you advocate for them developing those qualities? Because these parents who have now split have to sort of reinvent who they are. They're not a couple anymore. They're a single person parenting a child, and they hopefully they want to do what's best for that child, but how do you propose that they do the best possible job to co-parent and lead that child to flourish through divorce?
Well, there are really two answers to that kind of a question. And the first is you have to parent. And while that child is under your custodial care, you have to be the best parent you possibly can be to that child, regardless of your thoughts about the other parent. So the first aspect of it, you parent to the best of your ability. Now the second aspect is, how do you co-parent? Because sometimes you parent alone, and sometimes you have to co-parent. On a Tuesday night, when your child's having a temper tantrum and still has to get the homework done and you still have to do the laundry and you still have to get dinner on the table, you still have to pull up all those attributes of being as best a parent as you could possibly be to that child. This has nothing to do with your ex. This has to do with your ability to parent that child at that time. But then we come to the broader issues of co-parenting, where now together you have to form this new kind of identity as parents, but not husband and wife, or partners. And now you have to reach consensus on aspects of your child's life. This is where the focus on the child becomes so critical, that you no longer have to be able to say, it has to be my way, but it has to be a respectful way with your co-parent, one that accepts differences that may well have driven you apart, but expects and accepts that both of you have really the best interest of the child in mind. Look, there are three factors that really seem to determine how kids do long-term after divorce. Should I put my professor hat on for 5 minutes and give the lecture,
yes,
or should we save that one
for
later?
Yeah, no, give the lecture. I think
okay,
we need
it. Okay, we'll give the lecture for a few moments. My experience really is that when we look at what determines over time how these kids who have gone through the agony of separation and divorce survive over time, there are really three factors that really make a significant difference. The first factor is probably the one that we all thought about, we all know about, we all care about. Kids who grow up with both parents actively participating in their lives post-separation and divorce, kids who have a meaningful relationship with two parents actively post-separation and divorce, they just do much better academically, socially, behaviorally, period. The second factor that really seems to influence how kids do over time after separation and divorce is the ability of the kids to be able to see that their parents were still parents without rancor, without anger, without the war between the parents post-separation and divorce. Kids understand afterwards, my parents fought all the time when they were married. Duh, that's why they got a divorce. But when there's a heightened level of conflict post-separation and divorce, and the child's aware the only thing that binds my parents together is me, the child, and they're still at war with each other, then it's really sort of my fault, isn't it? Because I'm the only thing that keeps them together, and they're fighting with each other all the time. So kids who grow up and understand that their parents have a more business-like relationship with each other, they're not at war and at conflict with each other, not every transition is involving yelling and screaming in the driveway and threats to call my lawyer because you're 6 minutes late today. When the children are able to see that their parents have a business-like relationship with each other around the children, those kids do much better over time than the kids who grow up in conflict. The third factor that seems to really influence how kids do over time, and the lecture is nearly over, test will be next week, that really the third factor you can't have without the first two. Because unless you have the child having a meaningful relationship with both parents, and unless that relationship is absent of significant conflict and war, this third factor can't exist. The third factor is really the child's perception of seeing his or her parents still as parents, involved in making the critical decisions, positive and negative, in that child's life, regardless of the custodial arrangements of the moment. So what I mean by that is the kids who do well later on are able to look back and say, you know, when I was in fifth grade and I got the honorable mention in the science fair, and the science fair award ceremony was Tuesday night, I didn't have to worry about, was that mom's night or dad's night? It was my science fair. Both parents were going to be there. It doesn't matter. I can beam from the stage as I get my certificate, and I can smile at both of my parents at the same time because they're still parents. When the 14-year-old sneaks out at night from a friend's house and gets caught, it's both parents who are reading that child the riot act. It's both parents telling that child what the behavioral consequences of that might be. It's not one parent blaming the other parent. It's both parents still being parents to that child when that child is 16 years old. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, you know, do you ever, I hear so many people say, and they used to say it a lot more in the past, but, you know, we should stay together for the children. You know, I know this is a case-by-case basis, and it depends on the amount of conflict that's going on in the home, but do you ever have a recommendation for parents who have decided their marriage is over but want to stay together for the sake of the children? Do you ever have any advice for them one way or the other on that?
Well, look, you know, what's best for kids, you know, is a good marriage with good parenting. What's worse for the kids is a bad divorce with bad parenting. And then we have a whole range of things in the middle. So I think if you have a loveless marriage but decent parenting, that's maybe better than a marriage full of love with lousy parenting. But it really does become a unique situation dependent on the needs of the child. Parents do stay together for periods of time, and we all know of the cases where we stay together until the children are out of the house and onto their first jobs or onto college. Usually the kids know that it was a loveless marriage, and usually it does impact the children's ability later on to form appropriate, permanent, meaningful relationships themselves. So I don't think there's a universal answer. I don't think we can say, oh, stay together for the kids most of the time. Nor do I think
Ed, don't you think, and I hear this all the time with the adult children that I talk to, and you, both of you probably do as well, that although their parents stayed together for them, waited until they got out of high school or waited until they got out of college, it was no less traumatizing to them at that point as an adult that their children were separating. Or that their parents were separating.
Absolutely right. I just saw 3 hours ago a 25-year-old who just discovered that his parents were separating and getting divorced. And I saw the same emotional reactivity of that 25-year-old who's on his second job as I would see in an 8-year-old sitting in my office.
Yeah.
The same hurt, the same basic breaking of trust. Look, divorce is a breaking of trust. You trust that that family unit is going to be there to protect you and support you, whether you're 5 years old and you're on your way to kindergarten, or you're 25 years old and you're thinking about forming relationships. Divorce shatters that trust.
I really liked what you said a second ago about having a business-like relationship. I mean, my God, you make this sound as if it is the easiest thing in the world to do. You make it, you boil it down to a very simplistic sort of way to go about doing all of this, if people could just see through the anger and desperation that they feel through divorce. But looking at it as a business-like transaction seems to make so much sense. How do you get people to think that way about a divorce?
Well, I certainly is not going to say it sounds simple. It certainly, as we all know who work in this field, not simple to go through that process and view it as in a business-like manner. We all do such enormously caring things for our children. We spend a lot of money in piano lessons. We take them to soccer practices. We go to gymnastics. We hire tutors. We get braces. We stay up in the middle of the night when they're sick. We do everything we possibly can to promote the growth and development of our children. It's what binds families together. What I try to do is point out that if you really do care, and you really do care about the growth and development of your child, there's a certain way of doing it post-separation and divorce that will immunize your child from the hurt of separation and divorce. And that is by developing this business-like relationship. It works. And bottom line, if you care about your child, this is what works. Look, I've yet to see a child in my office who's really upset because he or she has to return from one parent's house to the other parent's house on Sunday night at 8 o'clock rather than go to school at Monday morning. But how many of us know that parents go to war about this? But I have seen numerous kids in my office who are disturbed and hurt and academically suffering and have trouble on the playgrounds because their parents are at war about whether or not the return is going to be Sunday night at 8 o'clock or Monday morning at 8 o'clock. So we have to point these issues out to parents who are themselves hurting and say, you're doing everything else for your children. This is what's really important.
And I think a lot of parents will get involved in the 50-50 split. I want a 50-50 split. I want this many nights a week, and on the following weekend I want that many nights. And they will fight over a day if you let them.
How about an hour?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, people add up hours during a course of a week, and you try to get them off that topic, and you say, well, what's best for the child? If the child wants to go to sleep in his bed that he's sleeping in most of the time and get up and go to school on time with a full breakfast and not running back and forth, maybe it's better that he or she stays somewhere else. And parents just don't get off of it. They can't see that it's not possession or it's not the number of hours. It's the quality, obviously, of the time you're spending with your child. And I don't know how you convince parents of those kinds of things. I have a hard time with that as an attorney.
Let me try to respond to that in two ways. I'm a firm believer in 50-50, but 50-50 as far as parenting. That's not to say that 50-50 as far as time.
Time.
There's a world of difference.
Right.
I believe that kids do better when they have two parents actively involved in their life, actively involved in decision-making, actively involved in raising these kids. And I don't like calling it 50-50. I call it 100-100. Both parents are all in as parents. And that I absolutely believe is in the best interest of kids. I've yet, however, to see a study that points to any one living arrangement for a child being any better or worse than any other living arrangement for a child. Let me say that again. There's no evidence that I've seen that shows any one living arrangement for a child is any better or any worse than any other living arrangement for a child. Because quite frankly, if you go back to those three principles that I talked about earlier, if the parents are able to establish a living arrangement that allows the child to have a meaningful, consistent, real relationship with both parents, allows the parents to do that absent significant conflict between the parents, and allows both parents to be the ones who are still parenting this child, then does it really matter whether the child, as you said before, sleeps 6 nights a week here and 7 nights the next week there and 4 nights the next week there? That doesn't become the significant issue. Kids accept what parents will tell them as far as the specifics of the living arrangement. Parents always tell kids what to do. Parents do it because that's in the child's best interest. And whether it's 60-40 or 50-50 or every other weekend with a Wednesday night sleepover or a 2-2-3 arrangement, there is no evidence that any one of these is better or worse than any other. It's a question of how do we do this so that the child has a relationship with both parents? How do we do it so the parents can parent without conflict? How do we do it so that both of these parents are still parents for the life of these child? Of this
child? I think what you're saying, Ed, is that that children are adaptable to the daily living arrangements. They can eat dinner here one night and go to dinner there another night, but what they can't deal with is the conflict, period.
Absolutely.
Right. Right, and the important thing is that both parents send the same message that they have to spend time with that child every week. That they're having a consistent message to that child, so that child knows he or she is still part of a family. But Ed, what I want to ask you is this: when people engage in a parenting agreement when the children are very young, don't you have to sort of adapt differently as that child grows? Because we know that a 14 to a 17-year-old girl is going to want to do different things than she wanted to do when she was 6 or 8. So how should a parent react when, for example, the 16-year-old says, well, Dad, you know, I can't come over tonight because I have cheerleading and my friends want to go out for pizza afterwards? What should the response be, and how do you handle that through adolescence as your children mature and grow into young adults?
Well, first of all, welcome to the world of adolescence. And it's the same factor whether it's divorced families or non-divorced families and intact families. Because guess what? Karen, have you ever seen a single agreement that was drafted at age 4 or 5 for a child that still held the way it was written at age 16 for the child?
No. Everything changes. The child really has a lot more to say and probably should.
The child has a lot more to say and probably should. The needs of the child change drastically. It's lovely to say that on Wednesday nights, every other week, from 4:30 to 7:30, the child will have dinner with a parent, and the parent will be responsible for completion of homework. And that's a great concept, perhaps, for a 7 or 8-year-old. Now, if your child has a physics exam tomorrow in honors physics and is in the school play and running track, is that child going to have dinner with that parent on Wednesday night for those 3 hours? Would that child in an intact family have 3 hours with that parent? Does your 16-year-old daughter ever spend an entire weekend with you? It just doesn't happen. And if it does, I would say, you know, kudos to you, but let's make sure it's really okay and that child is not just fulfilling your needs, but having its or her needs fulfilled as well. So these documents, while the basis of agreements, and I'm not the attorney, Karen, you know, you certainly can pipe in on this one, they have to be a foundation that allows for the developmental needs of the child. And it has to be something that we can adapt over time. And when that 16-year-old girl says, you know, I'm really not going to want to spend the weekend sleeping over at Dad's house this weekend, that doesn't mean your dad's not a parent. Dad has to figure out an alternative way of entering into the life of the child, into the child's interests and needs, not necessarily to say, oh, but my contract written 10 years ago reads, you have to be here.
I love what you said, Ed, in the book, entering the life of your adolescent rather than insisting that she enter yours does not mean that you give up. It just means that you have become realistic. I love that.
You're still the parent. You're still going to be there involving rules. Just, she may not sleep at your house Friday night. Guess what? She's probably not sleeping at your ex's house every Friday night either. She's not rejecting you in favor of your ex. She probably has three girlfriends who are watching some silly movie and eating pizza and making, you know, jokes about boys who they like. It's not
a
rejection of you.
From a parent's standpoint, you know, to give their thought process some validity, you know, when you're an intact family, you're sharing your daughter with the family and her friends, essentially.
Right.
But when you have sharing a three-way with two different households and their friends, then it becomes a little thin. And I think parents do feel like, I haven't seen her in 5 days. I need to see my daughter. And that's about them, you know, and it's about the child as well. But you can understand why a parent gets a little nervous about those things.
And that's great, and that's valid. And what you should do is, instead of insisting necessarily that our agreement from 15 years ago reads such, you should look at your child and say, okay, what is she into? What's she doing? How am I going to get involved? If she's running track, you're going to show up at the track meet, and you're going to drive her back to wherever she needs to be afterwards. You're going to stop off with some food because she is going to want to eat. You're going to have your conversation with her there. You're going to take her out for lunch on a Saturday. You're going to do some shopping. You're going to do something to enter into her life rather than insist that she just enter into yours. No differently than you would if you were absolutely in an intact family. Before, I said there were two pieces to this. This parenting and this co-parenting. Parenting also means for the 16-year-old recognizing how he or she needs to be independent and autonomous and yet have boundaries and rules. And you're still going to do that in a divorced family. You're still going to be able to say, do I really spend all weekend with my 16-year-old child? I would love to as the parent. Believe me, I would love to be able to have said I spent all weekends with my kids. That would be for me. Got to tell you, they didn't really want to spend all weekend with me.
And, you know, what I see a lot, too, is, and I'm going to switch topics just slightly, is when people are in an intact relationship, there's one parent who may make certain decisions. Let's just say the woman makes decisions about medical. She takes the children to the dentist. She takes them to the doctor. She really, you know, doesn't really consult with the husband to say, is it okay if I take, you know, she just takes care of that, let's say, or maybe the food issues or whatever. And maybe the husband takes the kids to sports. I'm being a little stereotyped here, but
a little,
when, a little. But or vice versa. But when parties divorce, all of a sudden, both parents want to get involved in all decisions about everything. So you see one parent saying, well, he never cared what the kids ate. My gosh, he took the kids to McDonald's, and now he wants them to go vegan. You know, so you have these parents getting involved in areas where maybe they didn't have decision-making by virtue of just the agreement between the parties. And so what I've done a lot in some of my parenting agreements, if I'm able to get people to agree to it, is to basically say, all right, Mom, since you've been the one who does all the medical stuff, maybe you should be making those decisions primarily, unless it is something so significant that the husband has to get involved with the decision as well. Vice versa, with picking activities or school homework or academic decisions or religious decisions, that one parent has a primary decision-making role. Have you used those kinds of agreements, Ed, in your counseling or advocated for their use?
Yes, when I've made some parenting agreements, I do, but I think we also have to be very careful of that because, again, the dynamics changed and we're not sure how they're going to fall out. What we might have had was, you know, I'll go with the traditional role that was thrown out a moment ago. You know, mom was primarily involved in the medical decisions. Mom met with the school teachers about how the child was doing in math. Dad did the sports events on Saturday, and that was the traditional role, perhaps, that they explicitly or implicitly accepted. But perhaps in a co-parenting arrangement, that has all changed now. And it demands of each of the parents to really be on and the parent for 100% of the time with that child when that child is with them. You're no longer sharing the responsibilities in some described or accepted fashion. You're now on all the time. So you're going to have to make the day-to-day food decisions, and you're going to have to make the day-to-day decisions about whether homework gets done now or later and what time bedtime is going to be for those times that the child is with you. And that changes the dynamic. So maybe mom was the one who made the medical decisions years ago, but that may change. And dad may take an explicit interest in that at this point. And I think we have to be careful about designating at age 5 what roles each of them are going to play later on. Sometimes it works out well, but we have a very difficult time having a crystal ball here and knowing what roles each parent's going to play. I think what becomes critical in this, though, is that each parent I request and sometimes I mandate really have to learn how to respect the parenting decisions and skills of the other parent. This comes up all the time. You said vegan a moment ago. One parent eats organically and the other parent doesn't. One wants to be a vegetarian, the other doesn't. One believes in no television during the week, the other doesn't. You know, we see this all the time, post-separation divorce. The key to success of raising a healthy child is not to have a fight about whether organic broccoli is better for the child than non-organic broccoli, and to put down the parent who, for whatever reason, doesn't want to have organic broccoli. The key to this is to say, in our household, here's how we do it, and we believe in organic broccoli. You know, in the other household, regular broccoli's fine. What's far more important is that you eat a healthy diet and you eat your vegetables. Both households are okay. I push that parents really have to learn how to respect and support the parenting skills and decisions of the other parent. And that's probably one of the hardest things that I try to do in the co-parenting model.
Ed, when you get people to try to co-parent with your model and using this book, are you typically getting couples who have just entered into the divorce process, or are you talking with people primarily that are post-divorce and are trying to find their way from a co-parenting standpoint? Because I wonder about the people that I deal with on a daily basis who are mild, moderately, or severely alienated. How would you deal with all of those people parenting on that spectrum, from entering into the process all the way to the point where the kids are having no contact?
I'm actually an early intervention person. I'm an early intervention person in a number of areas of psychological health and development. And what I mean by that is I think the earlier you can jump in and try to predict the possibility of a problem and prevent it, you're much better off than trying to fix it 3 years down the road. So what I'm actually trying to do much more of is meet with folks as they're going through the process of separation, even before the divorce is finalized, and trying to teach the co-parenting model at that point, before any bad habits in this new world get formed. So you talked about doing it immediately post-separation divorce or long-term when there perhaps might be an alienation process going on, and I'm suggesting a third, probably more successful time period, which is early on. Parents are coming in saying, we're going to get a divorce. We're talking about it. What do we do to co-parent? How do we learn this new language? How do we deal with each other? And sometimes there's even a bit of schizophrenia, where you're saying, we're going to be in court tomorrow, we're suing each other for everything, and she's hiding bank accounts, and he has an offshore account, and we're going to fight each other for every dollar. But by the way, we're both still going to co-parent these kids. and we have to be able to reach the decision about whether or not allergy shots are going to happen 2 days from now.
And you know, let's face it, the legal system is not good when it comes to these issues. I always tell my clients that the worst person to make a decision in this whole venue when it comes to your children is the person who's paid by the government wearing the robe, because that person may or may not have children, may or not have
the work lab experience. Michelle's not here tonight, right?
Yeah, that's right. Now,
no, she'd
Michelle,
be the first
right?
one. She'd be the first one to say that, because yeah. why? And you know, I mean, she and I have preached this for years. Why would you ever allow a person who's been sitting on the bench for years, who wants to go home at 5 o'clock, who sees a snapshot of your family in 15 minutes, why would you allow them to make a decision about the future of your children and your future and pick the wrong thing? Why would you ever allow that?
And the system really encourages parents to be nasty to each other, in my view, in that if I want to sue for custody, I have to say that the other parent is an unfit parent. That's a horrible thing to say in writing about somebody who you had a child with, who may read that, and the grandchildren may read that someday online. It's a horrible system that pits people against each other, and it encourages people not to talk to each other. Talk to my lawyer. Nothing gets done through lawyers, nothing substantive when it comes to children. So I think that this is getting this kind of counseling before the divorce is a fabulous idea for everybody.
A number of years ago, I recall getting a call from a judge, a very wise judge who'd spent a number of years in juvenile and domestic relations, who was totally frustrated. He had had a 15-minute emergency motion, and in many jurisdictions, as you well know, there are these emergency motion days where particular specific issues could be brought before the bench for resolution. And the emergency motion on the face was just whether a child was going to be playing softball or soccer. And the parents could not agree on which sport this child was going to be playing. The judge looked down, and there had been 4 full file boxes of previous judicial rulings and hearings on this particular case. This judge had not heard any of the cases previously. The judge had 15 minutes to make a ruling about this child's life. The judge was very aware it was much more than soccer versus softball. It was power, control, hostility between the parents. But the issue that day, the judicial system allowed this judge to decide on, was whether the child would be playing soccer or softball. The call from the judge was, Ed, help me here. There's got to be a better way of dealing with this. An awareness from that judge was something that I found enlightening, mm-hmm. that this judge was certainly aware that there were issues that were far greater than this judge had the ability, the time, to be able to deal with. And the
so
conflict
what was the call?
Between, I'm sorry?
What was the call then? What call did you make?
It led to conversations, and it led to a model that really allowed, I think, greater parent coordination processes to go on. And for listeners who aren't very familiar what parent coordination is a process, often post-separation divorce, where either a trained lawyer or mental health professional really gets involved with the parents to help them reach decisions about their child that they get stuck on in a co-parenting model. It assists them in implementing the judicial order, understanding the needs of the child. It assists them in learning a different method of communication post-separation and divorce. And then at situations where the parents are stuck, helps the parents reach some resolution, sometimes by compromise, sometimes by issuing recommendations, based on that person's understanding of the child. So you'd never have a situation where someone who is absolutely blind to the history having to make a decision about soccer or softball. And this model of parent coordination then, I think, has really grown extensively over the last several years, in part with great support from the legal system, because the judges are saying, we just don't know this family. Get someone who knows the needs of the child. Why should I be the one parenting here? Can't you get these parents to parent?
It's a great tool. It's a very recent tool, and I advocate for that all the time. It's so much less expensive. It's like having a mini mediator involved in your child's life all the time. And I think that it also, in some cases, encourages the parents to behave a little bit better, because they know that when they're being unreasonable and not agreeing to something they should be agreeing to, that someone's going to be looking over their shoulder immediately on the issue. And the other good part about it is so many decisions for children have to be made right away. And when you leave it to the court system and filing a motion and briefing it and getting a hearing date, by that time, the choice of school is already too late. The kid's
Correct.
Already in a different school district, and the whole issue is gone and done, and the party who has the child custody wins. And these are decisions that can be made very quickly and hopefully correctly. Big advocate of it. I think all states now kind of have some form of this.
So let me tell you a little secret about it. People get scared because people think, someone else is going to be raising my child. I'm not going to give up the power, the ability to make those kinds of decisions. I don't want someone who doesn't know my child issuing directives or orders or recommendations. The truth of it is that a good parent coordinator will rarely issue a directive or an order. Because if you do those first couple of things, help the folks implement the order that they've already agreed to at a level that's developmentally appropriate for their child, and teach them ways of communicating with each other, solving problems, teaching them basic mediation skills themselves and compromising skills themselves, you never have to get to that third one. They'll reach the decision about soccer versus softball. They'll figure out, okay, one season it'll be in your neighborhood, a different activity, a different sport will be in your neighborhood next time. They'll reach those decisions themselves. You're not giving up power. You're just learning another tool on how to make decisions that you never really had to make before.
Ed, do you think for the most part, most parents, and I believe this, most parents through divorce really care about the future of their children and how they will be able to come out of divorce on the other side? What do you think about people who use their children? For example, if you've agreed to co-parent, but then the sort of negativity starts creeping in, and mom's saying, well, I'll miss you so much this weekend. I probably won't sleep. Make sure you call me if you get afraid or you think you want to come home. How do you deal with these parents who were successfully co-parenting and maybe something went a little bit awry and now the negativity starts to creep in?
Well, I would sort of argue that probably it's not that everything was going well and then things started to go awry. I think probably the difficulties were there in that parent even before, and it just gets exaggerated by something else. Again, you start off with the basis that most parents do love their children and do want what's best for their children. There are times that particular emotional or psychological difficulties with a particular parent will prevent that parent from being the best parent or he or she can be. And we have to address those issues. You can't just ignore them if there's a significant anger management issue or there's a significant level of depression or there's a thought disorder or there's a significant personality disorder. We can't just say everything will be fine and we're going to sing Kumbaya around the campfire and everything will be lovely. I think those issues have to be addressed, but they have to be addressed also in the context of how it impacts the life of the child. So what we try to do in these kinds of situations is a twofold attack. Yes, you're the parent, and we have to help this person see the negative impact of their behaviors at that moment on the child. What does that child hear when you say, be careful now when you go to daddy's? You know, sometimes he falls asleep in the middle of the afternoon after he has his special little soda, and he can't wake up in case there's a problem. We have to really inform the parent what the impact of that behavior is on their child so that they have a clear understanding it's not just scoring points against the other parent, but it really is impacting negatively their child. And then we also have to address whatever the significant issue might be. Maybe dad does have drinks in the afternoon and falls asleep. Well, he's caring for the child, and that's a problem. But also maybe mom just is imagining that dad's having these drinks in the afternoon because that meets her own agenda and her own needs that aren't fulfilled. And we have to figure out what those needs are and help her figure out a way of fulfilling them in a way that's adult-like and allows her child to grow and thrive without the mother's involvement in that degree.
I thought maybe, and Jill, you're totally unprepared for this, I'm springing this on you, but I had an issue with a client of mine, and maybe Jill and you and I can pretend like we're parents, and I'd like to see how Ed kind of tries to bring us together. Obviously, it may not happen in the time span we have, but I had a client who is a girl who's maybe 8 years old, and she's a very beautiful girl, and the mother wants her to model, and there's money in it for her, and she's been told that she could make money, and we all know that college education costs, and it might be a good thing for her to make some money and to get the confidence level to do it. But the father's very against it because he's worried the daughter's going to have eating disorders. He thinks it's not a good use of her time and that she should be out, you know, playing and doing things like that rather than worrying about the way she looks. So if I'm the mother and I want my little girl to model and I say I think it's the best thing in the world, and Jill, your position is I don't think it's a good idea, how do you talk to us, Ed? How do you get us together? Because this is not an insignificant issue. This is not softball versus soccer. This is something that has some import and some long-term impact for a child.
Well, let's first start off by saying I'm not sure it's that much different than soccer. How many 8-year-olds think their child's going to get a soccer scholarship to college, and how many parents of 8-year-olds think that their child's going to be the next gymnastics Olympic star and pay for the parents' retirement? And I think the odds and probability of an 8-year-old going on to be the professional model may be about as high as, and I don't know as much about modeling as I do about some of the other extracurricular areas, but probably the odds are probably about as great as going on to being a Major League Baseball player. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my guess is the level of success and the pyramid to be successful is probably about as narrow along the way. So it may be the same kind of issue. But so how do we get parents to resolve? Why is this so important to parent A? Why is this not important to parent B? The first thing we have to do is get them together in a room and have them have a discussion about why they believe each of these their sides is so valued and so important. I know that first conversation is going to be the party line. They've talked about this to their lawyers, they've talked about this to their friends, and they're going to walk into my office and they're going to tell me everything that they've told everybody else before. It's really the second or the third meeting with these folks together where we're able to focus it on the needs of the child. What would modeling do to the child? How would that impact the child's growth and development? How would that impact the time the child is with each of the parents? What are the needs for the modeling? How will it affect other kinds of activities the child or the parents think are necessary in this life of the child? Let's put this into some degree of context. Who are we really pushing here? Is it the mother's need to have a child who's a successful model? Does the child really have whatever talent is necessary to pursue and to be that model? How do we pursue this then if we decide to go down that route? In a way that gives us lots of opportunities to evaluate father's concerns as well. Are we going to start in the process and make sure that we do it in a way that doesn't promote an eating disorder, that doesn't separate the child out from her peers, if that's father's concerns? Both parents, if this is a joint legal custodial arrangement, would have to reach agreement about this process. And it becomes a question of having each of them express what their needs are, express how they perceive the needs of their particular child, and reaching some level of compromise or consensus. They're the parents. They're going to have to decide. How would they have decided if they were together and happily married? There'd be give and take. There'd be a sense of, let's try this and see if she really does have talent. Let's make sure that father's concerns are addressed as well, so that we reach some element of checks and balances and compromises as we go through this process. And it's going to take, in this kind of a situation, several meetings of focusing on the child to allow these parents to reach whatever the decision they're going to reach. It's not my decision. It's going to be their decision as parents. And this is only going to be one of many difficult decisions. We work on both the process.
I see two parents with their feet in the sand, Karen, and I think probably the little girl will go to the modeling calls unbeknownst to the father. And he'll see her maybe on the front of a magazine or in an ad, and that's how it's going to end up.
that's your crystal ball there, huh?
I think that's a dirty crystal ball.
The dirty crystal ball.
Because I think dad is going to be at his attorney's office,
right,
and he's going to be filing because it's a parenting decision that impacts his time as well, and it was a decision made without him.
You know, I have found, though, that decisions like this, I do think this is a little bit of a significant issue because, you know, I do think that these kinds of things can probably affect a child adversely and maybe positively. But, you know, it's interesting you get so many people with so many different reactions to how to parent that they feel very strongly about this issue one way or the other. But it is a frightening thought to put this in front of a judge because who knows where the judge is going to be wired, where he or she is coming from, and it could be some decision that...
Yeah, right. The day of the week, right.
And how much time he has left before he has to go home. So, yeah, it's very interesting to watch these problems resolve themselves. And, you know, I hope mine resolves itself before we have to present it to the court.
I truly believe that I look at this. This is not going to be a unique decision that these parents are going to have to make.
No.
This is an 8-year-old child. We're going to have to make other decisions about academics and where the child's going to go to school and whether the child should have a tutor and whether we should have braces or not and whether she should be allowed to date when she's 13 or 12 or 15 and whether she's going to go to college in-state or out-of-state and who's going to pay for those colleges. So we have to teach the process of reaching resolution to this that's different than the process of my lawyer will see your lawyer tomorrow and will resolve this. I'm not anti-lawyers. There's clearly times we need to have lawyers involved in helping folks reach resolutions to these kinds of things. But the first step is being a parent.
And then, Ed, do you think the second step is drilling into people's heads that divorce does not end your relationship with your ex? It doesn't end. I mean, I think so many people get divorced. They think, that's it. My hands are clean. I can move on. I'm done. But you have these children, and you have to be able to work through these issues. And I love what you said about getting to people before they decide to divorce, or just as they're deciding to divorce, and let them know what the consequences of not co-parenting are. But I'd like to take it even a step further. What about trying to get to people, just like the Catholic Church does? We were talking about the new Pope earlier, but the Catholic Church has such a great idea with pre-Cana classes and telling people what can happen if this ever does happen. I don't think the Catholic Church is going to talk about when and if you get divorced, but maybe there is a class somewhere that you go to before you get married that shows you what happens. Or maybe your book is a mandatory read for parenting classes.
Can you say that again a little louder, please?
Maybe your book is a mandatory. No, I've got a lady here that I'm working with in Sangamon County, Illinois, who is the only mandated teacher of parenting classes. And she is listening tonight. And this book is, I think, going to be one of her tools in her class. Because it's so important, and if we could make this mandatory all across the United States for people to read your book, what a change it's going to make in divorce culture.
Well, as we all know, to get a driver's license in most states, you need hours of training. You have to read the books. You have to know the rules. You have to have some behind-the-wheel experience, and you've got to pass a test. And we all know that you don't need to do that in order to have a baby.
No.
And you don't need to do that to raise a baby. And the literacy that we have as far as child rearing is pretty limited. And we could get into it another time about why that is and extended families not being involved in much of what we learn about parenting, we learn from our own parents. But the truth of it is, there's no test that we have to take. There's no core of knowledge. There's no one who evaluates how we raise our children. Most of us do a pretty good job, though. Most of us really do raise kids with love and care and compassion. It gets hurt sometimes during divorce, and we lose track of what's the most important thing, and the most important thing is to continue to love and raise that child with that caring and that compassion, even if we sort of hate our ex.
And one of the things that I just feel a little bad about, which is my clients who are really good parents and are trying to do the right thing, will read your book. But the parents who are not doing a good job and who are fighting about stupid things and who are angry and have long-term resentment, they're not going to sit down and read your book, or they're going to read it and say, well, that doesn't apply to me. I guess my question to you is, if you believe your spouse is the angry one, and maybe you're the angry one too, who knows, how do you get your spouse to calm down? How do you tone it down and sit down and really have that person listen to you and just convey these issues to that person? You're hurting your child, or this process is harming our child. How do you do it without?
Well, first of all, I think you forget that you're the one who's going to be able to do it, because if you couldn't change your ex while you were still married, you're not going to change your ex when you're divorced. Right. Your ex is going to be the last person to listen to you about his or her strengths and weaknesses after you're separated and divorced. The focus can only be the focus on the child. The focus can only be not on your flaws as an adult, your flaws as a parent, your anger, your alcoholism, your neglect, your inability to set limits. The focus is really on, let's look at our child and what our child needs. And from that discussion, obviously, there'll be disagreements, but the focus has to remain on the child. Look, you couldn't change each other. You were together. What makes you think you're going to change each other now?
Well, Ed, tell us about the book, where we can get it, how to contact you if you want to give out that contact information, and anything else that you want to tell us about you and what's going on in your life right now as far as if you're doing any seminars or conferences.
Well, I just got a new puppy.
my
best wishes. So that's what's going on in my life right now.
And what kind of puppy did you get?
I got a beagle, and she is 13 weeks old, and I swore after my last dog died that I wasn't going to get another dog, and I held on for a while, but I lost. So that's what I'm doing with my life. But the name of the book is Raising the Kid You Love with the Ex You Hate, and it's available at all local bookstores, Barnes & Noble's and independent bookstores. It's available online at Amazon.com and BarnesandNobles.com and a number of other sites as well. It's available in paperback and on electronic versions through the Kindle, Nook, iPad, and there's some other version, which I don't really know what it is, but it's another electronic version as well. The website, I'll give the plug right now, is RaisingTheKidYouLove.com, and the Facebook page as well is Raising the Kid You Love, and love to have people look at the Facebook page, and often there are bits of tidbits of advice that people can take away from and interact with. There's a tweet as well at Raising the Kid You Love, and I hope that's the right address. Maybe it's Dr. Edward Farber.
Well, Googling is easy too, so we can find you. I hope that everybody runs, doesn't just get to Barnes & Noble, get to Amazon, get to wherever you can to get this book. If you know somebody who's contemplating divorce, get this book as a gift for them. This is a gift. And we have to take this very seriously. Karen, you should buy 100 copies to give out to all your clients.
I think I'm going to do that. And I'm also going to get a discount, I think.
I think so.
But you know, some advice.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What?
Some advice for your listeners who are going through a divorce or contemplating divorce. You know, find, not only get counseling, as we talked about, but find a lawyer who is going to have some sensitivity to the issues with your children. You know, I feel like as lawyers,
absolutely,
we have an obligation over and above knowing the law, advocating, persuading, and doing all those things. Sure, cases have to be tried, but the best kind of settlement is when all the lawyers and all the parties sit in one room and we hash it out, and maybe there's some tears and maybe there's a little bit of voice raising, but we get it done outside the court system. So find a lawyer who's able to do that and not to to blow it out of the water and make it an ordeal that that you can't live with.
And they exist. They're out there.
I can't agree with you more, and there are marvelous lawyers out there who will protect your interests legally, but also ensure that the future of your children are also protected in this endeavor, which is a haul. But again, the majority of people get through it, and they get through it well, and they love their children. I advise people, take care of yourself. It's a hard process. Continue to love and raise your children to the best of your abilities. And I certainly agree with what you just said. Make sure you have a lawyer who you trust, but who has a larger vision, who also is involved in caring for the love and life of your children.
Well, for those of you that are listening that are in the big, small world of parental alienation, because we all kind of know each other, I want to let you know that our guru in the parental alienation world, Dr. Richard Warshak, has endorsed this book, and in saying that if you are divorced or contemplating divorce, you need this book. Follow Dr. Farber's wise and practical rules, and your children will flourish after the breakup. They will be secure in the knowledge that your love for them trumps your disappointments in the marriage. So Dr. Warshak has endorsed this. Everybody who's experiencing parental alienation, read the book. I mean, you may have no contact at this point, but you need to read this book. Edward, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Jill, Karen, it truly was a pleasure, and I really enjoyed having this conversation with both of you.
Nice
we
to meet you, Ed.
You so very much, and I would like to ask you to come back, and I will follow up with you on that, and we'll have a whole nother show. This hour goes too quick when the content is so exciting and interesting, and again, thank you. Take care of that beagle. I'm going to go take care of my 13-week-old Bernese Mountain Dog puppy.
Oh, I don't think they'll meet. It could be a problem. Mine's 7 pounds.
Mine is 48 pounds.
Thank you both so
one.
Much, and good luck to all the listeners in helping you know, continue to love those kids that you do love.
That's right. Raising the kid love ex you hate. Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Karen, for being here tonight.
You're welcome, Jill. Thank you.
Good night, guys.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.